Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, I'll be talking with novelist Patty Friedman, whose new book is Do Not Open for 50 Years. We'll also hear from Margaret Aldrich, author of the Little Free Library book, and Nikki Lealy, who is New Orleans' youngest Little Free Librarian. Except for rare forays out of town for education and natural disasters, novelist Patty Friedman has always lived in New Orleans, chronicling Jewish life here with wit and irony and razor-sharp insight. Every now and then, she threatens to quit writing, but thank heaven, that never lasts. She's with us today to talk about her most recent novel, Do Not Open for 50 Years, the final book in the Two Jewish trilogy. Well, Patty Friedman, welcome to The Reading Life.
Hi, Susan. Good to see you.
It's been a while since we've heard from Darby Cooper, who's the recurring character in these books. So what's she up to in this one?
Well, I've carried this trilogy over a 50-year period, and now, inevitably, she went through Hurricane Katrina.
And she got a little older. She's 62 now. And she's wildly successful, isn't she?
Yes, that's the beauty of fiction. I could take my narrator and make her a best-selling novelist.
I love that. Give her a little gift. So this is the third in a series, Too Jewish. The exact image of mother is now Too Jewish, the Next Generation. And now Do Not Open for 50 Years. Did you think from the very beginning that you were going to make this a trilogy, or has it just kind of expanded and grown organically for you as Darby's grown?
It's been all a complete surprise. I wrote Too Jewish for completely different reasons than anything that would have had to do with anything that followed chronologically. Mm-hmm. That story germinated by a short story that appeared in New Orleans Noir, and I built it rather than moving forward in time. I moved it back in time so that what happened in 1960 in the short story was led up to from the Holocaust. Uh-huh. So that story was 50 years ago, 60 years ago, 70 years ago. And I felt that that was self-contained. And then Julie Smith, who published it, said, you know, your novel that came out in the 90s, The Exact Image of Mother, really works as a sequel to it. And I thought, well, yeah, I guess that's what happens when you plumb the depths of autobiographical material. Mm-hmm. So we used it as a sequel to Jewish. And then, inevitably, I got into the mood to write a third book in what became a trilogy. So it's all very confusing, especially to those people who followed my work and originally read The Exact Image of Mother. They buy the book and they say, hey, wait, I read this already. But the three pieces fall together pretty tightly. That's the way it happened. I didn't intend it that way, but I feel as though I've completed it. I don't think there should be a fourth story, although there certainly could be, projected into the future.
You never know. So tell us about the plot of Do Not Open for 50 Years, because it's kind of complicated. I love the title because it's kind of a challenge and an invitation. It's like, all right, don't open it for 50 years, but oh, damn, I have to know.
Kind of reminds me of that book that came out in the 60s, Buy This Book or I'll Shoot the Dog.
Yeah, or Steal This Book.
Oh, yeah, right. Oh, how could I forget? And there's a suitcase on the cover of the book, and you think, what is this all about? Do not open the suitcase. Do not open this book. What is it? But I take the title from something that happened in Too Jewish, where the father of Darby is doing an oral history for a project that was coming out of New Orleans or Mississippi or somewhere. And he is a Holocaust survivor. And he says, I will talk about this, about some of my personal experience, but I want to stipulate that these words that I say are not opened for 50 years, because right now I have a 12-year-old daughter and I do not want her exposed to the horrors that I've experienced. And so that's where Do Not Open for 50 Years comes from. But of course, that's in some ways a metaphor for what can be opened, what can be revealed.
And all kinds of family secrets, you know, the kinds of things that are revealed in this book.
True. And also, there is a little bit of a mystery, because when Katrina hits, Darby's mother is still alive. Darby's now very spoiled mother, Letty, who has disappeared, and all we know about her is that her Chanel luggage has disappeared.
Right.
So we see a Chanel-like suitcase on the cover of the book.
Lots of baggage. Now, this is a book about mothers and daughters and grandmothers and granddaughters, too. So you've explored these roles over and over again. What is the easiest one for you, and what's the most challenging? Because in the time that I've known you, you've become a grandmother, for example.
Right, and I get very mixed up when I write these characters. I'm sure the older and more senile I get, the more confused I'm going to get about who is who. But the exact image of mother got its title from a Jules Pfeiffer cartoon. I hated the way I turned out, so everything I did with my daughter was the opposite of what my mother did with me. And now my daughter has turned out the exact image of my mother. So there's a complete confusion among the many generations. And in the exact image of mother, you see the possibility that the daughter is going to turn out flighty and spoiled like her mother. We see some possibilities of that coming to pass in Do Not Open for 50 Years.
It's absolutely true. All these tangled lives of women is fascinating to read. Now, the other thing about this book is that you've gone back to writing about Katrina, and you have bravely written several books set in that post-Katrina time. So is this it for you? Do you think you're done with Katrina yet? Do you think it's still something you're going to write about?
Well, I've actually written a couple of novels that I don't know what I'm going to do with yet. And there isn't anything in Katrina except that, you know, that's what was going on in 2005. But in this book, Do Not Open for 50 Years, there's a lot of feeling about a theme of damage. And at one point, Darby goes to New York and does an interview with someone who makes a comparison between Katrina and the Holocaust. And Darby goes to her agent and she says, I think that's a disgusting comparison. Because in some ways, I mean, Katrina was certainly a huge tragedy, but you can't trivialize the Holocaust by comparing it to Katrina. And yet, I feel that this book, in some ways, does draw some lines between the two events. I personally had an experience. My son is named after my father, and my father had survivor guilt because he left Germany and had to leave his mother behind. And that's a theme that plays out in this whole trilogy. And when Katrina hit, I refused to leave New Orleans. You know, New Orleans isn't going to be damaged by the storm. And my son left. And when he got to Houston, he cried for a week because I was surely dead. And I was able to tell my son, you know, all I thought about was your safety. I didn't feel bad about myself. You don't have to feel guilty. And I wished I could say to my father, your mother died in the Holocaust, but I promise you, she never held anything against you. So I personally had to work out the comparison between the right. Holocaust and Katrina in this novel. Even though it's not explicit, it's implicit in
right.
Do Not Open for 50 Years.
Now, I wonder if you'd read us a little section set in the Katrina period when Darby is hunkered down in her mother's house and she gets some visitors. I think a lot of us will recognize this.
Yeah, this scene takes place after the storm, and not everybody had this opportunity. I had no interruptions until the National Guard came 2 weeks later. I know now that I was a spoiled, rotten, rich, white woman, everything that was wrong with New Orleans. While I was eating Honor's Pepperidge Farm cookies and washing them down with sealed cartons of vanilla soy milk, people were drowning and starving and being shot by police in distant parts of the city. I had seen smoke over the trees from my back window and heard no sirens, and the smoke kept going for hours. I had a sense that it came from a thickly populated part of Carrollton, so I got my news the way I would have 200 years past. Big fire, no firemen, or too much water for fire trucks. But I saw no way to try to help. I'd become accustomed to the kind of silence only possible with fingers and ears, and even fingers and ears make an exaggerated noise if they move, so any sound could be heard from quite a distance. I heard the banging from about 10 houses down. When it came closer, I opened the front door a crack and saw a half dozen men in military uniform moving from house to house. I bet they were terribly hot in those uniforms, which included hip waders. That seemed a little much, since the water had gone down almost to dry in the past few days. They would pound on a front door, walk around, confer as if they were serious, then one of them would spray paint on the sidewalk. As they left the house next door, I stepped out just as one was saying, "Hey, there's a car here." He was terribly excited, and I almost felt bad for him, the way I was ruining his detective work. "You don't have to paint the sidewalk," I said. It felt funny talking. I hadn't spoken in over 2 weeks. "Every other neighborhood we paint on the front doors," the blonde one said. He looked terribly proud of his power. I could hear in his tone that he was authorized to paint my door if I got out of hand. He was possibly 20 years old. He approached me as if I were dangerous or fragile. "You know there's an emergency here," he said. I laughed. He took a step forward. He'd added crazy and subtracted fragile. "You can't stay here, you know," he said. "I've done a good job so far," I said. A black kid, possibly even younger than the blonde guy, stepped forward. "Ma'am, you know the whole city closed?" "That sounds like good news to me," I said. "You got to get out of here," the blonde guy said. He was close enough now for me to read his name tag, Robertson. I looked at the other one's tag. Nash. "So, Mr. Nash," I said to the other one, "if the city is closed, I think I'm pretty safe here."
And that is vintage Patty Friedman, I must say. I love it. We've been talking with Patty Friedman, who reads from and signs Do Not Open for 50 Years, Thursday, May 14th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Patty, thanks so much.
Great to be with you, Susan.
Probably noticed those little free libraries popping up all over New Orleans, and chances are there's one in your neighborhood somewhere. Now these charming little book exchanges, based on the principle of take a book, return a book, have a beautiful book all their own. Minneapolis writer Margaret Aldrich is the author of the Little Free Library book, and we're very happy to have her with us today. Margaret, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you, and thank you so much for having me.
So how did you become aware of Little Free Libraries yourself?
Well, I had first written about Little Free Libraries while I was an editor at Etney Reader, and then shortly after I started seeing them pop up in my own Minneapolis neighborhoods. And at first, I have to admit, I thought they were too good to be true, that I could take a free book and get rid of a book that I thought someone else might enjoy. But as we all know, they are true.
They really are. It's one of those few things that people get immediately. I love that little free library. You know, it's such a simple concept, and it's spread worldwide and so quickly. So I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about the history and what you discovered about the growth of little free libraries.
Well, the first little free library was built in Hudson, Wisconsin, and that was in 2009 by a man named Todd Bowl. And he immediately saw his neighbors react so positively to this little box of free books and thought, you know, I think we really have something here. So he tested it out, and little by little they spread from Wisconsin around the Midwest and very quickly to New Orleans through Linda Prout, who had read about them in a newspaper. And so, you know, bit by bit, they started expanding their reach around the country and soon around the world. And now there are 26,000 Little Free Libraries. They're in all 50 states, and they're in 80 different countries around the world. And they're on every continent now except for Antarctica. So I don't know how Little Free Library will conquer that, but who knows?
Well, maybe somebody will hear this and take up the challenge. I think that would be so great. Well, we've had Todd on the show before when he came to New Orleans to celebrate Little Free Libraries. And I find it so interesting that it all grew from this very simple human impulse to honor his late mother, you know, which I thought was so, so dear. But now it's grown into this lovely movement around the world. And I wanted to ask you about some of the more unusual ones you talk about in this book. You talk about the Little Free Library sponsored by the Los Angeles Police Department.
That's really one of my favorite stories from the book. You know, as you said, these Little Free Libraries sprung from one man, one simple idea that's just gone on to do some great things. And the Los Angeles Police Department is hoping to kind of cultivate that same feeling in their city. And so they're using Little Free Libraries, placing them in police precincts, and inviting the community to come in and use the Little Free Library and get to know the police officers as real people. So they're hosting story time for kids. They're just talking to each other more than they ever have. And I think that's such an amazing way to use a Little Free Library.
And then there are these Little Free Libraries that are constructed by the inmates of the Prairie du Chien Correctional Institute.
That's an amazing program as well, where inmates at the prison are taught carpentry and construction skills, and they build Little Free Libraries as kind of a way to give back to the community. So they're learning a skill as well as strengthening neighborhoods in need.
And you found Little Free Libraries in India, Pakistan, Ukraine, Iceland, South Korea, Australia. I mean, it's just an amazing array of things that you've got in this book. Now, New Orleans has more than 60 Little Free Libraries, and they are very special indeed. And you feature one of my very favorites, which is the Library of Linda Prout, who was one of the very first people in Louisiana to have one.
Oh, her story is just amazing. I mean, she's really what the Little Free Library movement is all about. And Todd Bowl, the founder, says this all the time, that Little Free Libraries are allowing individuals to be heroes in their own communities. And I love what Linda has done by, you know, establishing these Little Free Libraries, kind of strengthening that feeling of community and helping people talk more and just spreading a little bit of kindness and good in the world.
Well, one of the other things that springs from putting a Little Free Library up is that so many people have used them as a vehicle for artistic expression and creativity.
Oh, absolutely. That's one of my favorite things about them. You know, if you ever go on Little Free Library's Pinterest page or Instagram page, you can get lost for hours looking at the unbelievable things that people have done creatively with their Little Free Libraries. You know, I've seen Little Free Libraries that look like robots or Volkswagen buses or owls or Victorian mansions. And there's one locally in Minnesota that looks like a life-size replica of Doctor Who's TARDIS that people have come to visit from all over the world. So just that creativity has been a phenomenal thing to see happen.
And people put them in unusual things like old newspaper vending machines and tree trunks. It's just...
Exactly.
You know,
you can just buy a Little Free Library that's already built. But the innovative ways that people have constructed them is fascinating. You know, I've seen an old kitchen cabinet becomes a Little Free Library, or an old wash basin becomes a Little Free Library. The creativity is amazing.
Now, the other thing that the book does that's very helpful is give people some notion of how to get started.
It is really easy to get started with a Little Free Library, and that's one of the things that I love about the movement, is that it's very inclusive. You don't need a lot of money to do it. You don't need a whole lot of time to do it. It's something that we can all accomplish. So you can either buy a Little Free Library that's already made and ready to be put up, or you can build one out of recycled materials. You can build them out of anything that you have on hand. There's no rules on what your Little Free Library looks like. And the only thing you need to do to make it official is to register it on the Little Free Library website, and then they send you a sign to put on the front. So, you know, it's something that I've really found that it's a manageable project for people to do, either by themselves or by gathering friends and neighbors together to help build it.
So do you have one yourself? I'm just curious.
I do. We have a Little Free Library. I live in Minneapolis. And my kids really love it. And it's something that has gotten them excited about reading. And that's a story that I also hear from a lot of other Little Free Library stewards, is that it's kind of sparking this love of reading with kids, because they get to come up to the Little Free Library door and open it like it's a present and see what's inside. And what's inside is changing every day. So we love ours.
It's so much fun. I think everybody should have one. Oh, well, we've been talking with Margaret Aldrich, who's the author of the Little Free Library book. She will be appearing with Todd Bowl, one of the co-founders of Little Free Libraries, at a Friends of Little Free Library potluck dinner Saturday, May 16th at 6 at the Family Life Center of Aurora United Methodist Church. That's at 3300 Eaton Street in Algiers. Bring a favorite dish to share and RSVP to NOLALibrary@yahoo.com by May 14th. Come on out if you're a library steward or user, or if you're interested in becoming one. Margaret will also sign her book Saturday, May 16th at 2 o'clock at Octavia Books. Margaret, thank you so much. I look forward to seeing you.
Thank you.
Words hit you, hallelujah. Woo! Words hit you, hallelujah. Woo! Words hit you, hallelujah. Woo! Cause I'm Red Book, gonna give it to you. Woo! Cause I'm Red Book, gonna give it to you. Cause I'm Red Book, gonna give it to you. Saturday night and I'm in my seat. Don't believe me, just read. Come on!
Nikki Lialli is the youngest Little Free Librarian in New Orleans. She started hers when she was only 6 years old, and she's kept it going for the last 3 years. She's done some innovative things with her library, and she's received great recognition for it. Her family's been recognized as a point of light during National Volunteer Week. So, Nikki Lialli, Little Free Librarian, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you.
How did you find out about Little Free Libraries in the first place?
Well, I was volunteering for something called Bead Town, and Miss Linda Proud was also volunteering, and I believe she was telling my mom about it, and my mom told me.
So why did you want one yourself?
Personally, I like to help my community, so that's why I was volunteering for something called Bead Town.
And you like books, too, I bet.
Yes.
So you did some really hard work to get your Little Free Library started, didn't you? Tell us what you did.
Well, I wrote a grant, and they were only giving out 3 little libraries at the time, and I was not in the top 3. But they changed their mind, and I got one of the 10.
Yay! So tell us about yours. Tell us where it is and what it looks like.
Well, mine is actually painted to look like my house, and it's on Louisiana Avenue, right in front of my house. And it had a little fairy house in front, but now it has a log painted purple.
Mm-hmm. What kind of books do you like to keep in your Little Free Library?
I take in all books, so adult books, children's books, magazines, cookbooks, anything.
Great. Now, how did you stock it in the beginning? How did you assemble your first collection?
Well, at that time, I was actually in a private school. And I asked the whole entire school, I put up flyers, if they could donate books. And I got a bunch of boxes, and that was enough to stock the year.
That's just great. And then you've had book drives since then to keep it going, haven't
yes,
you?
Yes, I have.
So tell us how your Little Free Library is different from others.
Well, my library is a little different than most of the Little Free Libraries because Most are set up in neighborhoods, but mine is in front of a really long, busy street.
Yeah.
And there's a bunch of tourists and a lot of kids from, like, unfortunate neighborhoods who don't have little free libraries. And there are a lot of my neighbors and people who live close by, too.
Now, one of the projects that's meant a lot to you in your work has been Global Youth Service Day. And you've used that to really do some interesting things to support your library.
Yes, ma'am, I have. We had two at my house and one in the Garden District. And the last recent one was not too long ago. And Yogurtland was supporting me, and Yogurtland on Britannia. And they're helping me where that week there was, if you bring in a book, you get buy one, get one free yogurt.
So that's a way to keep books coming in all the time. And this is a great week to talk to you because this is the week that the Little Free Library book came out. And you're in that book, aren't you?
Yes, ma'am, I am.
So this week, while we're celebrating the publication of the Little Free Library book, people can go to Yogurtland and leave books for your library, right?
Yes, ma'am.
That's great. Well, we've been talking with Little Free Library steward Nikki Lialli, the youngest Little Free Librarian in New Orleans. And you can meet her Saturday, May 16th at 6 at the potluck for Little Free Library stewards and users and want-to-be stewards. We're going to have a blast, aren't we?
Yes.
Thank you so much, Nikki.
Thank you.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Greg Alexander, author of the novel The Holy Mark, discusses dreams as a plot device Tuesday, May 12th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Today's guest, Patty Friedman, discusses and signs Do Not Open for 50 Years Thursday, May 14th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. The Waves presents its third reading Thursday, May 14th at 7 at Press Street, 3718 St. Claude Avenue. Readers include Michael Jeffrey Lee, Elizabeth Lindsay Rogers, Sarah Slaughter, and David Schneider. The Women's National Book Association of New Orleans meets Thursday, May 14th at 7 at the Bright Library at Metairie Park Country Day School. Todd Bowl, founder of Little Free Libraries, is a special guest. All are welcome. Deb Burst signs Louisiana's Sacred Places and Hallowed Halls of New Orleans Saturday, May 16th at 11 at Maple Street Bookshop. The Dickens Fellowship of New Orleans finishes up their discussion of Bleak House Saturday, May 16th from 2 to 4 at the Bright Library at Metairie Park Country Day School. Today's guest, Margaret Aldrich, appears with Todd Bowl, founder of Little Free Libraries, to sign the Little Free Library book Saturday, October 16th at 2 at Octavia Books. They will also appear at a Friends of Little Free Libraries potluck dinner Saturday, May 16th at 6 at the Family Life Center of Aurora United Methodist Church, 3300 Eaton Street in Algiers. Bring a favorite dish to share and RSVP to NOLALibrary@yahoo.com by May 14th. Come on out if you're a library steward or a user, or if you're interested in becoming one. Eleni Gage signs The Ladies of Managua, Sunday, May 17th from 2 to 4 at Garden District Bookshop. Pat and Patrick Sharon, a mother-son writing team from New Orleans, will discuss and sign their books, The Tavern, The System, and The Neighborhood, Tuesday, May 19th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.